Fangloy, ikaw na katulor ali fataga. Fangloy, ikaw na katulor ali fataga. Fangloy, ikaw na katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 90th of the Cthulhu Podcast. I'm FNH. As usual, we'll start with the next part of Through the Brazilian Wilderness. Then we'll have a 1928 musical number, and then on to part 8 of At the Mountains of Madness. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, part 51. On the afternoon of February 15th, we reached Campos Novos. This place was utterly unlike the country we had been traversing. It was a large basin, several miles across, traversed by several brooks. The brooks ran in deep swampy valleys, occupied by a matted growth of tall tropical forest. Between them the ground rose in bold hills, bare of forest and covered with grass, on which our jaded animals fed eagerly. On one of these rounded hills a number of buildings were ranged in a quadrangle, for the pasturage at this spot is so good that it is permanently occupied. There were milch cows, and we got delicious fresh milk, and there were goats, pigs, turkeys, and chickens. Most of the buildings were made of upright poles with roofs of palm thatch. One or two were of native brick, plastered with mud, and before these there was an enclosure with a few ragged palms and some pineapple plants. Here we halted. Our attendants made two kitchens. One was out in the open air, and one was under the shelter of an ox hide. The view over the surrounding grassy hills, riven by deep wooded valleys, was lovely. The air was cool and fresh. We were not bothered by insects, although mosquitoes swarmed in every belt of timber. Yet there was much fever at this beautiful and seemingly healthy place. Doubtless, when settlement is sufficiently advanced, a remedy will be developed. The geology of this neighbourhood was interesting. Oliveira found fossil tree trunks, which he believed to be of the Cretaceous Age. Here we found Amilcar and Mello, who had waited for us with the rear guard of their pack train, and we enjoyed our meeting with the two fine fellows, than whom no military service of any nation could produce more efficient men for this kind of difficult and responsible work. Next morning they mustered their soldiers, muleteers, and pack oxmen, and marched off. Reinschisch, the taxidermist, was with them. We followed in the late afternoon, camping after a few miles. We left the ox cart at Campos Novos. From thence on the trail was only for pack animals. In this neighbourhood, the two naturalists found many birds which we had not hitherto met. The most conspicuous was a huge oriole, the size of a small crow, with a naked face, and a black and red bill, and gaudily variegated plumage of green, yellow, and chestnut. Very interesting was the false bell bird, a grey bird with a loud metallic note. There was also a tiny soft-tailed woodpecker, no larger than a kinglet, a queer hummingbird with a slightly flexible bill, and many species of ant thrush, tanager, manakin, and toady. Among these unfamiliar forms was a vero, looking very much like our solitary vero. At one camp, Cherry collected a dozen perching birds, Miller a beautiful little rail, and Kermit, with the small Luger belt rifle, a handsome carasso, nearly as big as a turkey, out of which, after it had been skinned, the cook made a delicious canja, the thick Brazilian soup of fowl and rice, than which there is nothing better of its kind. All of these birds were new to the collection. No naturalists had previously worked this region, so that the afternoon's work represented 9 species new to the collection, 6 new genera, and a most excellent soup. 2 days after leaving Campos Novos, we reached Vilhena, where there is a telegraph station. We camped once at a small river named by Colonel Rondon the 12th of October, because he reached it on the day Columbus discovered America. I had never known before what day it was. And once at the foot of a hill, which he had named after Lyra, his companion in the exploration. The 2 days' march, really one full day and part of 2 others, was through beautiful country, and we enjoyed it thoroughly, although there were occasional driving rainstorms when the rain came in almost level sheets and drenched everyone and everything. The country was like that around Campos Novos, and offered a striking contrast to the level, barren, sandy wastes of the Chapadeo, which is a healthy region where great industrial centres can arise, but not suited for extensive agriculture, as are the lowland flats. For these 48 hours, the trail climbed into and out of steep valleys with broad basins, and up and down hills. In the deep valleys were magnificent woods, in which giant rubber trees towered, while the huge leaves of the low-growing pacova, or wild banana, were conspicuous in the undergrowth. Great azure butterflies flitted through the open, sunny glades, and the bellbirds, sitting motionless, uttered their ringing calls from the dark stillness of the columned groves. The hillsides were grassy pastures, or else covered with low, open forest. A huge frog, brown above, with a light streak down each side, was found hiding under some sticks in a damp place in one of the improvised kitchens, and another frog, with discs on his toes, was caught on one of the tents. A coral snake puzzled us. Some coral snakes are harmless, others are poisonous, although not aggressive. The best authorities give an infallible recipe for distinguishing them by the pattern of the colours, but this particular specimen, although it corresponded exactly in colour pattern with the description of the poisonous snakes, nevertheless had no poisoned fangs that even after the most minute examination we could discover. Miller and one of the dogs caught a seriema, a big long-legged bustard-like bird, in rather a curious way. We were on the march, plodding along through as heavy a tropical downpour as is our ill fortune to encounter. The seriema, evidently as drenched and uncomfortable as we were, was hiding under a bush to avoid the pelting rain. The dog discovered it, and after the bird valiantly repelled him, Miller was able to seize it. Its stomach contained about half a pint of grasshoppers and beetles and young leaves. At Vilhena there was a tame seriema, much more familiar and at home than any of the poultry. It was without the least fear of man or dog. The seriema, like the screamer and the curassow, ought to be introduced into our barnyards and on our lawns, at any rate in the southern states. It is a good-looking, friendly, and attractive bird. Another bird we met is in some places far more intimate and domesticates itself. This is the pretty little honey creeper. In Colombia, Miller found the honey creepers habitually coming inside the houses and hotels at mealtimes, hopping about the table, and even climbing into the sugar bowl. Along this part of our march, there was much of what at a hasty glance seemed to be volcanic rock. But Olivia showed me that it was a kind of conglomerate with bubbles or hollows in it, made of sand and iron-bearing earth. He said it was superficial quarantary deposit formed by erosion from the Cretaceous rocks, and that there were here no tertiary deposits. He described the geological structure of the lands through which we had passed as follows. The Patanals were of Pleistocene age. Along the upper Sepetoba, in the region of the rapids, there were sandstones, shales, and clays of Permian age. The rolling country east of this contained the eruptive rocks, a polyphritic diabase and zeolite, quartz, and agate of a Triassic age. With the Chapadeo of the Parasis Plateau, we came to a land of sand and clay, dotted with lumps of sandstone and pieces of petrified wood. This, according to Oliveira, is of Mesozoic age, possibly Cretaceous, and similar to the South African formation. There are geologists who consider it of Permian age. The music this week is from 1928. It's a song called Me and the Man in the Moon, and it's by Helen Kane. Helen was a star on stage, record, and film in her day. She was also cited as the inspiration for the cartoon character Betty Boop. If my plans hang together, you'll be getting a special episode focusing on her coming down your feed in the next couple of days.
Why did my wheelie me? Why did we have to part? You know, no other sweetie can relieve me of this aching heart. Why can't I have the sunshine? The sunshine instead of gloom. Why must I have these little shadows creeping in my room? When the night is dark and peaceful, loving hearts are all in bloom. There's two loads of people in the whole wide world. It's me, the man in the moon. When the little birds are nesting, and I listen to them croon. I'll get another sweetie soon. Because there's two lots of people in the whole wide world. It's me and the man in the moon. Oh, but how I miss his ukulele. And the way he strums so smooth. Because there's two lots of people in the whole wide world. It's me and the man in the moon. When the creepy shadows fall and the boogeyman comes to call, I need two lovable arms around me. You know, and it's my sweetie sleeping, waiting. You know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna get myself a big balloon, big one, and I'll travel through the air. And that big balloon have a love affair with the man in the moon.
And now on to the main feature. At the Mountains of Madness. Chapter 8. Naturally, Danforth and I studied with a special interest and a peculiarly personal sense of awe everything pertaining to the immediate district in which we were. Of this local material there was naturally a vast abundance, and on the tangled ground level of the city we were lucky enough to find a house of very late date, whose walls, though somewhat damaged by a neighbouring rift, contained sculptures of a decadent workmanship, carrying the story of the region much beyond the period of the Pliocene map, whence we derived our last general glimpse of the pre-human world. This was the last place we examined in detail, since what we found there gave us a fresh, immediate objective. Certainly we were in one of the strangest, weirdest, and most terrible of all the corners of the Earth's globe. Of all existing lands, it was infinitely the most ancient. The conviction grew upon us that this hideous upland must indeed be the fabled nightmare plateau of Leng, which even the mad author of the Necronomicon was reluctant to discuss. The great mountain chain was tremendously long, starting as a low range at the Luitpold land on the east coast of Weddell Sea, and virtually crossing the entire continent. That really high part stretched in a mighty arc from about latitude 82 degrees east, longitude 60 degrees to latitude 70 degrees, east longitude 115 degrees, with its concave side towards our camp, and its seaward end in the region of that long ice-locked coast whose hills were glimpsed by Wilkes and Mawson at the Antarctic Circle. Yet even more monstrous exaggerations of nature seem disturbingly close at hand. I have said that these peaks are higher than the Himalayas, but the sculptures forbid me to say that they are the Earth's highest. That grim honour is beyond doubt reserved for some which half the sculptures hesitated to record at all, whilst others approached it with obvious repugnance and trepidation. It seems that there was one part of the ancient land, the first part that ever arose from the waters after the Earth had flung off the moon and the old ones had seeped down from the stars, which had come to be shunned as vaguely and namelessly evil. Cities built there had crumbled before their time and had been found suddenly deserted. Then, when the first great earth-buckling had convulsed the region in the Comedian Age, a frightful line of peaks had shot suddenly up amidst the most appalling din and chaos, and Earth had received her loftiest and most terrible mountains. If the scale of the carvings was correct, these abhorred things must have been over 40,000 feet high, radically vaster than even the shocking mountains of madness we had crossed. They extended, it appeared, from about latitude 77 degrees, east longitude 70 degrees to latitude 70 degrees, east longitude 100 degrees, less than 300 miles away from the dead city, so that we would have spied their dreadful summits in the dim western distance had it not been for that vague opalescent haze. Their northern end must likewise be visible from the long Antarctic Circle coastline of Queen Mary Land. Some of the old ones in the decadent days had made strange prayers to these mountains, but none ever went near them or dared to guess what lay beyond. No human eye has ever seen them, and as I studied the emotions conveyed in the carvings, I prayed that none ever might. There are protecting hills along the coast beyond them, Queen Mary and Kaiser Wilhelm lands, and I thank heavens no one has been able to land and climb those hills. I am not as sceptical about old tales and fears as I used to be, and I do not laugh now at the pre-human sculptor's notion that lightning paused meaningfully now and then at each of the brooding crests, and that an unexplained glow shone from one of those terrible pinnacles all through the long polar night. There may be very real and very monstrous meaning in the old Noctic whispers about Kadath in the cold waste. But the terrain close at hand was hardly less strange, even if less namelessly accursed. Soon after the founding of the city, the great mountain range became the seat of the principal temples, and many carvings showed what grotesque and fantastic towers had pierced the sky where now we saw only curiously clinging cubes and ramparts. In the course of ages, the caves had appeared and had been shaped into adjuncts of the temples. With the advance of still later epochs, all the limestone veins of the region were hollowed out by groundwaters, so that the mountains and foothills and plains below them were a veritable network of connected caverns and galleries. Many graphic sculptures told of the explorations deep underground, and of the final discovery of the Stygian sunless sea that lurked at the earth's bowels. This final nighted gulf had undoubtedly been worn by the great river which flowed down from the nameless and horrible westward mountains, and which had formerly turned at the base of the Old One's range and flowed besides that chain into the Indian Ocean between Bud and Totten lands on Wilkes' coastline. Little by little, it had eaten away at the limestone hill's base at its turning, till at last its sapping currents reached the caverns of the groundwaters and joined with them in digging a deeper abyss. Finally, its whole bulk emptied into the hollow hills and left the old bed towards the ocean dry. Much of the later city as we now found it had been built over that former bed. The old ones, understanding what had happened, and exercising their always keen artistic sense, had carved into ornate pylons those headlands of the foothills where the great stream began its descent into eternal darkness. This river, once crossed by scores of noble stone bridges, was plainly the one whose extinct course we had seen in our aeroplane survey. Its position in different carvings of the city helped us to orientate ourselves to the scene as it had been at various stages of the region's age-long, eon-dead history, so that we were able to sketch a hasty but careful map of the salient features, squares, important buildings and the like, for guidance in further explorations. We could soon reconstruct in fancy the whole stupendous thing as it was 1,000,000 or 10,000,000 or 50,000,000 years ago, for the sculptures told us exactly what the buildings and mountains and squares and suburbs and landscape setting and luxuriant tertiary vegetation had looked like. It must have been a marvellous and mystic beauty, and as I thought of it, I almost forgot the clammy sense of sinister oppression which the city's inhuman age and massiveness and deadness and remoteness and glacial twilight had choked and weighed on my spirit. Yet according to certain carvings, the denizens of that city had themselves known the clutch of oppressive terror, for there was a sombre and recurrent type of scene in which the old ones were shown in the act of recoiling affrightedly from some object, never allowed to appear in the design, found in the great river, and indicated as having been washed down through waving vine-draped cycad forests from those horrible westward mountains. It was only in one late-built house, with the decadent carvings, that we obtained the foreshadowing of the final calamity leading to the city's desertion. Undoubtedly, there must have been many sculptures of the same age elsewhere, even allowing for the slackened energies and aspirations of a stressful and uncertain period. Indeed, very certain evidence of the existence of others came to us shortly afterward. But this was the first and only set we directly encountered. We meant to look further on, but, as I have said, immediate conditions dictated another present objective. There would, though, have been a limit, for after all hope of a long future occupancy of the place had perished among the old ones, there could not have been a complete cessation of mural decoration. The ultimate blow, of course, was the coming of the great cold, which once held most of the earth in thrall, and which has never departed from the ill-fated poles. That great cold that, at the world's other extremity, put an end to the fabled lands of Lomar and Hyperborea. Just when this tendency began in the Antarctic, it would be hard to say in terms of exact years. Nowadays we set the beginning of the general glacial periods at a distance of about 500,000 years from the present. But at the poles, the terrible scourge must have commenced much earlier. All quantitative estimates are partly guesswork, but it is quite likely that the decadent sculptures were made considerably less than 1 million years ago, and that the actual desertion of the city was complete long before the conventional opening of the Pleistocene, 500,000 years ago, as reckoned in terms of Earth's whole surface. In the decadent sculptures, there were signs of thinner vegetation everywhere, and of a decreased country life on the part of the old ones. Heating devices were shown in the houses, and winter travellers were represented as muffled in protective fabrics. Then we saw a series of cartouches, the continuous band arrangement being frequently interrupted in these late carvings, depicting a constantly growing migration to the nearest refuges of greater warmth, some fleeing to the cities under the sea off the faraway coast, and some clambering down through networks of limestone caverns in the hollow hills to the neighbouring black abyss of subterranean waters. In the end, it seems to have been the neighbouring abyss which received the greatest colonisation. This was partly due, no doubt, to the traditional sacredness of this special region, but may have been more conclusively determined by the opportunities it gave for continuing the use of the great temples on the Honeycomb Mountains, and for retaining the vast land city as a place of summer residence and base of communication with various mines. The linkage of old and new abodes was made more effective by means of several gradings and improvements along the connecting routes, including the chiselling of numerous direct tunnels from the ancient metropolis to the Black Abyss, sharply down-pointing tunnels whose mouths we carefully drew, according to our most thoughtful estimates, on the guide map we were compiling. It was obvious that at least two of these tunnels lay within a reasonable exploring distance of where we were, both being on the mountainward edge of the city, one less than 1/4 mile towards the ancient river course, and the other perhaps twice that distance in the opposite direction. The abyss, it seems, had shelving shores of dry land at certain places, but the old ones built their new city under water, no doubt because of its greater certainty of uniform warmth. The depth of the hidden sea appears to have been very great, so that the earth's internal heat could ensure its habituality for the indefinite period. The beings seem to have had no trouble in adapting themselves to part-time and eventually, of course, whole-time residence under water, since they had never allowed their gill systems to atrophy. There were many sculptures which showed how they had always frequently visited their submarine kinsfolk elsewhere, and how they had habitually bathed on the deep bottom of their great river, and darkness of the inner earth could likewise have been no deterrent to a race accustomed to long Antarctic nights. Decadent though their style undoubtedly was, these later carvings had a truly epic quality where they told of the building of the new city in the cavern sea. The old ones had gone about it scientifically, quarrying insoluble rocks from the hearts of the honeycombed mountains, and employing expert workers from the nearest submarine city to perform the construction according to the best methods. These workers brought with them all that was necessary to establish the new venture. Shoggoth tissue, from which to breed new stone lifters and subsequent beasts of burden for the cavern city, and other protoplasmic matter to mould into phosphorescent organisms for lighting purposes. At last a mighty metropolis rose on the bottom of that Stygian sea, its architecture much like that of the city above, and its workmanship displaying relatively little decadence because of the precise mathematical element inherent in building operations. The newly bred Shoggoths grew to enormous size and singular intelligence, and were represented as taking and executing orders with marvellous quickness. They seemed to converse with the old ones by mimicking their voices, a sort of musical piping over a wide range, if poor Lake's dissection had indicated aright, and to work more from spoken commands than from hypnotic suggestions, as in earlier times. They were, however, kept in admirable control. The phosphorescent organism supplied light with vast effectiveness, and doubtless atoned for the loss of the familiar polar auroras of the outer world. Art and decoration were pursued, though of course with a certain decadence. The old ones seemed to realise this falling off of themselves, and in many cases anticipated the policy of Constantine the Great, by transplanting especially fine blocks of ancient carving from their land city, just as the emperor in a similar age of decline stripped Greece and Asia of their finest art to give his new Byzantine capital greater splendours than its own people could create. That the transfer of sculpted blocks had not been more extensive was doubtless owing to the fact that the land city was not at first wholly abandoned. By the time total abandonment did occur, and it surely must have occurred before the polar Pleistocene was far advanced, the old ones had perhaps become satisfied with their decadent art, or had ceased to recognize the superior merit of the older carvings. At any rate, the eon-silent ruins around us had certainly undergone no wholesale sculpture denudation, though all the best separate statues, like other movables, had been taken away. The decadent cartouches and dados telling this story were, as I have said, the latest we could find in our limited search. They left us with a picture of the old ones shuttling back and forth betwixt the land city in summer and a sea cavern city in winter, and sometimes trading with the sea-bottom cities off the Antarctic coast. By this time, the ultimate doom of the land city must have been recognized, for the sculptures showed many signs of the cold's malign encroachments. Vegetation was declining, and the terrible snows of winter no longer melted completely even in midsummer. The Sornan livestock were nearly all dead, and the mammals were standing it none too well. To keep on with the work of the upper world, it had become necessary to adapt some of the amorphous and curiously cold-resistant Shoggoths to land life, a thing the old ones had formerly been reluctant to do. The great river was now lifeless, and the upper sea had lost most of its denizens, except the seals and whales. All the birds had flown away, save only the great grotesque penguins. What had happened afterward we could only guess. How long had the new sea cavern city survived? Was it still down there, a stony corpse in eternal blackness? Had the subterranean waters frozen at last? To what fate had the ocean-bottom cities of the outer world been delivered? Had any of the old ones shifted north ahead of the creeping ice cap? Existing geology shows no trace of their presence. Had the frightful Maigo been still a menace in the outer world of the north? Could one be sure of what might or might not linger, even to this day, in the lightless and unplumbed abysses of the Earth's deepest waters? Those things had seemingly been able to withstand any amount of pressure, and men of the sea have fished up curious objects at times. And has the killer whale theory really explained the savage and mysterious scars on Antarctic seals, noticed a generation ago by Borchgrevink? The specimens found by Paul Lake did not enter into these guesses, for their geologic setting proved them to have lived at what must have been a very early date in the land city's history. They were, according to their location, certainly not less than 30 million years old, and we reflected that in their day the sea cavern city, and indeed the cavern itself, had had no existence. They would have remembered the older scene with lush tertiary vegetation everywhere, a younger land city of flourishing arts around them, and a great river sweeping northward along the base of the mighty mountains towards a faraway tropic ocean. And yet we could not help thinking about those specimens, especially about the 8 perfect ones that were missing from Lake's hideously ravaged camp. There was something abnormal about the whole business, the strange things we had tried so hard to lay to somebody's madness, those frightful graves, the amount and nature of the missing material, Gedney, the vital unearthly toughness of those archaic monstrosities, and the queer vital freaks the sculptures now showed the race to have. Danforth and I had seen a good deal in the last few hours, and we were prepared to believe and keep silent about many appalling and incredible secrets of primal nature. We're now on to the home stretch of the mountain story, so I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that I'm on the lookout for listener story submissions. You can find guidelines for story submissions on the website at cthulhupodcast.co.uk. That's all for today, except to remind you that the opening music is by Victor Valdez from the Symbol Project. This file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk.